Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're closing out a week of short stories by Duluth author Connie Ellis. Today's story is titled Picnic in Venice. It's a tale of a Venetian artist and shopkeeper who sells lace. Connie also has a novel titled Picnic in Venice. The two are unrelated except for the fact that they are both set in Venice. Picnic in Venice, the story, which we are about to hear, was published in 1999 in Skylark, the literary magazine of Purdue University. And now we'll hear Connie Ellis reading her story, Picnic in Venice.
Picnic in Venice. There goes Stefano, the artist, and right on time. He passes Rose Vacanti's lace shop every morning at 7:15, a scarf trailing behind his black coat, a sketchbook under his arm. His dark hair is a mass of curls just covering his ears, which he believes to be the right length for an artist. He's a vain man, good-looking, despite his odd nose, which twists slightly to the right, and sharp enough that one thinks of cartilage upon observing him closely. Rose's cartilage, however, is not apparent. She is a solid woman, a woman of bone. "Morning, Stefano," Rose says as she cranks open her awning. "How are you this morning?" He says, stopping as usual to admire her blue awning. He likes the lace curtains in the window, too, intricate curtains with bird shapes, white doves, which seem to float in a lacy white web. Rose smiles, waiting to see what he has to say today, though sometimes he says nothing. "Sun's coming out," he says solemnly, "and you know, I have a good feeling about today, just a really good feeling." He adjusts his silk scarf, wishes her a good day, then strides off down the street. Rose watches him walk away. His long legs look wobbly, quivery, like reflections of tall trees in water, and she lets her mind go as wavery as his wobbly legs until she's nearly in a trance, her mind as empty as the early morning air. Not until he gets to the bridge does she come back to herself, to her everyday self, and returns to her shop. Another day, she says, entering the tiny lace shop. Phoebe is sweeping the floor in front of the cash register, where the sun is shining on the floor. Phoebe sweeps the oak floor methodically, left to right, sweeping over the grain in the wood, as if trying to sweep more than mere dust. Her hair hangs forward as she works, flimsy, silky hair, dangling like broken birds' nests and sparkling in the morning sun. "That's fine, Phoebe. It looks just fine." Phoebe looks up at her mother, unsure, then stands upright and smiles. She leaves the broom in the corner and follows her mother outside. "Here you go." Rose sets a cup of milky coffee on the little table near the door, where Phoebe can sit and watch the people and boats go by. "Thank you, Mama," Phoebe tells her mother as she settles down with her coffee, gently touching the small red birds that circle the rim of her cup. Rose stands beside her daughter for a moment, a feeling of something to be said at the tip of her tongue. She doesn't know what, but it feels just right, knowing something, something rather nice, is lingering in the morning air, in the sunlight about them. Rose knows. People say feeble Phoebe behind her back. She doesn't mind their being two-faced because they ask so nicely after Phoebe. She's forgiving. They don't know Phoebe, though, not really. Not that Rose understands her daughter either. But now with Stefano coming by like he does, she's starting to look at Phoebe a little differently, a little more hopefully. She knows she's lucky to have Phoebe at all after the accident that took Joe. Phoebe was 4, and it had been a special occasion, her going along in the boat with her father to see the lace women out on the island. After they were far out in the open water, a fast-moving storm turned the tranquil sea into a swirling demon, and their small boat was flipped about like a toy and smashed to splinters in the massive waves. Rose crosses herself for the miracle of the old barge that spotted Phoebe bobbing up and down in her yellow life vest. They were able to get her breathing again, but she had been under too long, and great damage had already been done. They found Joe on the morning of the third day, waterlogged and blue, on the shore of the island of the lace makers, covered with seaweed, both boots still on his feet, and his nose gone. They told her she needn't do so, but she went along with Joe's brother to identify him. And now that seaweed face with the black hole has been the nightmare of her dreams for 14 years. She always sees him just under the surface of the water, the seaweed draped down over his forehead, over his bacon-white face, slimy green seaweed that drifts back and forth over to the black hole like the curtain of a horror show opening and closing, opening and closing. His boots bobbing up and down in the water is what wakes her. She wants the dream to go away, or at least to change. It's always the same old classic horror movie she's forced to watch year after year. Sometimes she thinks of Joe when she blows her nose. Gives her an odd, funny feeling, imagining herself without a nose. Better he lost the nose than an eye, she's always told herself. Sometimes she even laughs about the missing nose, then ends up gulping and choking, horrified at her own bad taste. She winces at the thought of still water in Joe's beautiful brown eyes. She adored his eyes. Eyes like a winking saint, she used to think, like the eyes of St. Peter in the stained glass window she sees every Sunday in church. Though, of course, St. Peter's eyes in the glass never wink. Rose sighs and readies the cash register for the day, then looks out at Phoebe. The front window curtain veils Phoebe's profile. The intricate lace against her delicate features make her seem like a fairy princess to Rose, like someone not quite real, someone not quite her daughter. Rose looks until the curtain is again just a curtain, and Phoebe is herself, gazing peacefully out over the water of the canal. Phoebe watches the water for such long periods of time that Rose wonders just what she sees, what she's thinking. Sometimes she concentrates on the sky, sometimes the water. Lately, the same thought keeps coming back to Rose. Is Phoebe an artist? Is she like Stefano? They both study the water and the sky. Other people don't do that, not so intently, not so single-mindedly. Stefano spends his days painting the bridges and canals of the city, the complicated old buildings reflected in the water. She sees his enthusiasm each morning, how he's ready for each new day like it will be a fresh and entirely new day, unlike any day that has gone before, just like Phoebe. Does it matter that Phoebe can barely print her name? Rose doesn't know, but she wants to get a glimpse of this world of light, of color, whatever they see, Phoebe and Stefano. Perhaps she could buy a box of pastels, just a small box, or colored pencils. She unconsciously opens and closes her hands, trying to express, to understand. When Belle stops by the store after lunch, and Gina takes over in the shop, instead of joining Belle and Phoebe in front of the TV, Rose is ready to catch a boat down to St. Mark's and look for Stefano. She'll watch him paint, that's all. She closes the door and tiptoes down the back stairs, leaving Belle and Phoebe to their black-and-white Western, the same one they watched together last week. The drone of the TV fades away like some old part of her life, and a boat motor takes its place. As she reaches the bottom step, she walks along beside a boat carrying construction materials, which passes under the bridge as she crosses over. Her old walking shoes squeak as she speeds up and cuts across the church square, her usual shortcut to the Grand Canal. A young man is playing the flute on the church steps, a Verdi aria she likes, though she's not sure which opera it belongs to. She pauses to listen. She hums the familiar theme as she continues on toward the open water of the canal. The Vaporetto pulls in just as she gets to the dock. Waiting her turn in the ticket line, the breeze from the water feels cool on her face, and she enjoys the sound of the waves gently sloshing against the dock. That small space of water between the dock and the boat makes her step back, recalling, as usual, the stage pit of her past. Before she married Joe, she studied scene painting with Alfonso, and had loved working on the enormous theater sets right up on the stage. The pit, that's what they called the deep slit in the stage where the canvas was raised or lowered as he worked on the scene, eliminating the need for a ladder or scaffolding. It took concentration to remember you were painting right next to a deep, narrow pit when you were painting tall, snow-capped mountains, or ships sailing into the harbor in a lavender twilight. But you had to be careful so you wouldn't fall in like that pigeon man who fell in and they found him down there the next day, unconscious, covered with dried blue paint like blue blood and all cut up from a smashed Chianti bottle. He suffered a concussion, broke several bones, and lost both his reason and his talent down in that pit. Now Pascali is the pigeon man over in the square, eating popcorn and walking around with his cheeks puffed out, flapping his elbows like he's a bird trying to take off. Rose takes another step away from the edge of the dock. She liked painting scenery, but she loved the theater, too. She liked the actors, with all their hugging and exaggerated ways, and the excitement of getting ready for a new play. The play of my life, she says to herself as she boards the boat. The couple behind Rose thinks she's being friendly, commenting to them. Like a postcard, the man says to her. You don't get the smells in the travelogue, the lady adds. Rose smiles without commenting. She is sure she's embarking on a journey of more importance than the short ride down the Grand Canal to St. Mark's Square. She finds herself walking to the front of the boat like an actress, taking rather formal steps in her old shoes. And she feels exceptionally alive. She takes a place up front to be closer to the water, to be out in the open so she can feel the sun on her face. The clouds have been coming and going all afternoon. She loves the way the boat surges forward as it starts down the canal. It's alive, she thinks, unsure if she means the boat or the canal. Immediately, they pass a racing gondola on its way out into the open water. She recognizes the man on the farthest back oar as the son of Joseph's old neighbor who made papier-mâché masks. She still has the gold cat mask he made. She narrows her eyes, recalling the cat's eyes. The water is oily smooth today, the waves rounded, never sharply breaking, not even at the extreme curves of the canal. Rose has always been happy out on the water. She always breathes more deeply, breathing with the sea, she calls it, the Great Mother Sea. She and Joe had that love of the sea together. She never lost it, even after Joe died, and Phoebe nearly so. She never blamed the sea. She settles back to enjoy the ride along the canal, watching all the old buildings. Their feeble old bricks showing through here and there are like parts of an old decrepit cake the city keeps trying to cover up with frosting. Even the blue and white striped water poles seem like festive parts of the cake, or candles for the big cake in the sea, and she loves both the old decomposing core as well as the ornate building facades. As they near St. Mark's, she sees Stefano. His easel is set up beyond the glass and coral stands, where she plans to go first and browse a bit. She should be able to observe him from there without his noticing. She may not even talk to him today. The postcard people open their map as soon as they get off the boat, which Rose finds odd, since you can't miss St. Mark's. She makes her way along quickly. It's crowded, but not like a weekend. She passes the first few vendors and stops at her favorite glass stand and begins to sort through the smaller items. She enjoys the imperfect pieces, the trays of pale, frosty glass, the small aqua plates, and bits of embedded color like small fish trying to swim through heavy water. Rose has her own glass collection, mostly inexpensive pieces she's bought at these stands, small, fanciful pieces she couldn't resist, in which she needs to hide from Phoebe, who is too clumsy to handle the glass safely. Rose's favorites are the little bird she keeps in a box and the clear glass paperweight Joe gave her for their first anniversary, with real gold swirling inside like stars. She takes the birds and paperweight out to admire when Phoebe sleeps. These are from the more expensive shops, not these outdoor stands. Rose peers through a clear, pale pink glass plate, looks toward the sky. Stefano comes up behind her as she's peering through the pink glass. He smiles and says hello, and she smells the garlic of his breath. I do that too, he tells her. Look through the glass. Now in Stefano's presence, Rose's fingers feel sweaty, and she fears she may drop the delicate piece. With a nonchalant concentration, she returns the glass tray to the table. My mother's name, and mine, Rose, she tells him, fingering some of the other glassware. Aha, he says, picking up the same tray she just put down. Rose the second. No, no, women don't bother with that second business, you know. Not in my family, she says, more seriously than she intended. Over at Stefano's easel, a man in a lime green coat is examining a painting. Customer, she tells him, nodding in the direction of his easel. He raises his eyebrows to thank her, and she watches as he rushes off. By the slight forward tilt of the man's head, Rose can tell the man is going to buy something. Rose finds herself humming, something she doesn't ordinarily do in public. Stefano says little to the man, mostly listens and nods his head, holding his hands behind his back. The man gets out his wallet. Stefano wraps the painting in tissue and then slides it into a cardboard case and tapes it up. They shake hands, and Stefano tucks the bundle of lira inside his jacket pocket with a gesture Rose finds both greedy and elegant. As the man in the lime green coat walks off with the painting, Stefano beckons to Rose, who has been walking slowly toward him since the man left with his painting. The sale was a good one, he tells her. Not only did he make out well, but they exchanged cards. Signor De Monti, very important guy. He has a gallery in Milan, and his brother is opening a second gallery in Paris. This is very good, Rose, he tells her, rolling forward onto the balls of his feet like he's going to take a little leap into the air, but then settles back onto his heels. Rose sighs and wiggles her toes inside her heavy shoes. Enough for today, he says. As he gathers his equipment together, she examines a small painting of a lone pigeon standing on a stone bridge above the silvery water of the canal in early morning light. Rose, Rose, I always think of you as the lady of the blue awning, Stefano says, adding the pigeon painting to his satchel. Come, celebrate with me. Rose laughs, a little surprised that he would ask an old woman like herself, with her thick socks and old-fashioned shoes, immediately wishing she had worn her new sweater, not this old brown one with the missing button. But she raises her chin, feeling ready for the unusual, and remembering the orange in her pocket, says, yes, let's celebrate. She holds up the orange like a prize. To the pigeons, she says, which is simply the first thing that comes into her mind. To the pigeons, and the Pope's nose, Stefano says with gusto, slinging his easel over his shoulder. Rose gasps, then starts to laugh, a small polite laugh behind her hand. Stefano laughs too, for the sheer joy of being alive, Rose thinks, and what a gift to be able to laugh. Pigeons can't laugh, the dead can't laugh, and she wonders if the Pope ever laughs. We can eat in Mario's boat, Stefano tells her. He's my old pal. I eat there sometimes. That's where I leave my equipment and paints at night. Crossing the square, they pass the postcard couple talking loudly at one another, and before they turn off to their side street, Rose sees a short, plump man videotaping Pascali, who is strutting around like a pigeon, his head wobbling on his neck like a weary, charmed snake, surrounded by curious pigeons and amused tourists. The pigeon man, Stefano says. The guy's an act. I've seen him after hours, dressed to kill. Leather jacket, expensive shoes, handmade shirts, fancy friends, too. He actually lives at the Danieli. No, Rose is so surprised, and it is hard to believe, seeing him so raggy and bent over here on the square. It's true, Stefano says. They walk to the end of the narrow street in silence, then both stop to look back toward the square at the same time. Sad, Rose says. Yes, and funny too, Stefano adds. Rose agrees, but neither laughs. They make a circle to get to Mario's boat, crossing two bridges and passing the glass shop where Rose buys her glass birds. the nearest cheese shop she likes, even though she knows it's overpriced, being so close to St. Mark's. Yet she insists on stopping to buy a nice thick wedge of cheese, Montanella. With the cheese and her orange, she feels prepared for a picnic on a boat. As they near the last bridge, the street narrows, and Stefano stops beside Mario's boat. Rose watches him uncover the boat and load the easel and paint box, and realizes they've become real friends, while just this morning they were formal acquaintances. The boat is a pretty wooden one. Although it's old, it's well made, with gold trim near the bow, and Rose feels comfortable climbing aboard. She settles down in the center seat, and Stefano sits at the stern. "Well, here we are, sitting in the middle of a painting," she tells him, accepting a glass of Chianti, which he holds carefully as the boat rocks gently, while Stefano sits back down. "Indeed, to sitting in the middle of a painting," Rose toasts. "And to painting," Rose toasts. "And to the sea," he says. "To the sea," she agrees. Rose peers over the edge of the boat and looks into the water. There's so many colors, pink and purple, azure, opal and rose, blues of every shade, even black. Could Phoebe paint these colors? Should she buy some pastels and let Phoebe rub the colors into the paper with her fingers? Watercolor would be too difficult, with the mixing and brushes and water too confusing. Acrylic? No, there would be a problem getting the caps off the tubes. "Indigo," Stefano says, "my favorite color. See it there in the darkest parts?" "Every color is there, it seems," she says, peering down at the sea beside them while they eat sections of orange. "Every color, every sound, every year. Everything is in there," Stefano says, finishing his wine. He stops to slice the cheese and hands Rose a thick slice. "I see myself, you," Rose says. "Good cheese. Pirates knew this sea, this same water, St. Mark's bones, poets, everyone. Excellent cheese. My Phoebe, too. She's there. The water took her. Left me a shell, a sweet pink shell." Rose drops an orange peel into the water and watches it float, then snatches it back, setting it on the seat beside her. Sitting upright again, she watches as Stefano starts to sketch. Rose recognizes her profile looking over the side of the boat. Without putting down his pen, Stefano hands her a sketch pad and puts the cigar box of colored pencils between them. Without hesitation, as if offered a ripe plum, Rose begins to draw. The end.
Se la memoria. si sa col tempo anche le rose. Un mattino non fioriscono più. E così andarono le cose. Anche il buon vento non soffiò mai più.
We've been listening to Mary Hopkin with the Italian version of what we know as Those Were the Days, the song she is best known for from 1968, and that put the crowning touch on Connie Ellis's story, Picnic in Venice. Tune in again next week. We will be having a placeholder for Literally from the North Shore for a few weeks or months, however it turns out. We're looking for help in producing Literally from the North Shore. If you would like to see this series continue, do contact us here at KTWH. You can write us at info@ktwh.org or leave us a phone message, 218-595-6195, or just stop by the studio when you see someone here in the Harbor Landing building. Thank you for listening.